You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, you've heard of the birthers, you've heard of the truthers, you've probably even heard of the tenthers and the nullifiers. It's now time to meet the Simpson bowlers. Over the past few years, we've heard a lot of crackpot ideas. First, there was Donald Trump and his jolly band of truthers who to this day claim that President Obama certainly wasn't born in the United States, probably in Kenya. Then came the Koch brothers-funded climate change deniers. They were, you know, working on the earlier work that they had done, denying that tobacco caused cancer, who, despite record temperatures and unprecedented superstorms, insist that man-made climate change is still debatable. You know, like many of the same people who said about cigarettes not causing cancer. Finally, we have the tenthers and the nullifiers who want to ignore federal laws that they don't like. But none of these outlandish, frankly insane ideas are as dangerous or as destructive both to the United States and to the, to us as a nation in whole and to the working people of the United States. Now, of course, it won't affect the 1%, but to the 99% of Americans, as this new Simpson Bowles cat food plan 2.0. Yesterday, the pair introduced a rebooted, or should we say rebaked, version of the original Simpson Bowles cat food commission idiocy. That original plan, you'll remember, was so bad that their own commissioners wouldn't vote for it. Unfortunately, the media is still in love with these irrelevant hustlers and their crazy ideas, which makes understanding the absurdity of the Simpson Bowles plan really hard to understand. But let's give it a try. In the original Simpson Bowles cat food commission plan, that pair and some of their buddies sought a whopping $2.9 trillion in budget cuts combined with $2.6 trillion in revenues. Fancy word that mostly describes increasing taxes or eliminating tax loopholes. It's about 50-50. Under the new Simpson Bowles cat food plan 2.0, this pair of crackpots is now seeking just $1.3 trillion in revenues, meaning they jacked up budget cuts this time around to a staggering $3.9 trillion. While the original cat food plan had roughly 1-to-1 spending cuts to new revenue, the new cat food plan is 3-to-1 cuts to revenue. Simpson Bowles cat food plan 2.0 calls for a $2.4 trillion increase in cuts over the next 10 years through, quote, serious tax and entitlement reforms and cutting additional spending. So what are the exact cuts and reforms that Simpson and Bowles want to make in federal government spending? Well, first they want to cut Medicare and Medicaid spending, meaning fewer and fewer elderly and poor Americans will have access to health care and medications. Next, Simpson and Bowles want to enact so-called comprehensive pro-growth tax reform, a fancy way of saying, we want to give corporations even more corporate tax breaks while jacking up taxes on working people. Of the $2.4 trillion in new savings, the Simpson Bowles' cat food plan 2.0 calls for, that the media is falling all over and doing everything but French kissing these guys on television, nearly $600 billion of it comes from so-called tax reform. And finally, these washed-up corporate shills want to strengthen limits on discretionary spending and reduce non-health mandatory spending, which frankly means cuts to things like Social Security, higher education, and farm subsidies, just to name a few. In other words, let them eat cat food! Bottom line here is that the Simpson Bowles cat food plan 2.0, much like its predecessor, is entirely about helping out corporate America and the billionaires who run it and screwing over the rest of us. Along with these so-called pro-growth tax reforms come these so-called entitlement reforms, which basically argue that we have to abandon elderly, disabled, and poor Americans in order to save the American economy. Right. You know, the only people who are happy with Simpson and Bowles' new cat food plan 2.0 are the corporations and their fat cat buddies. And the corporate media, of course, which is all over these guys. Although the millionaires on TV won't tell you this. The fact is that working class Americans need to see through all the smoke and mirrors and past the media circus and realize that much like the birthers and the truthers, the Simpson bowlers are completely off their rockers. No country in the world has ever cut its way to prosperity. Whether Simpson and Bowles like it or not, America's not going to either. It can't be done. So, real simple. Let's roll Grandpa Simpson and Grandpa Bowles back to the old folks' home where they can't do any more damage to our economy and to our country. And let's leave the cat food for the cats. I mean, this is pretty straightforward stuff. This is not rocket science. The Congressional Progressive Caucus has actually offered a budget plan that involves raising taxes on super rich people up to 50%, the top marginal tax rate. And that's just 50%. I mean, that's lower than it was for most of the 20th century. Raising capital gains taxes. Oh, my God. Mitt Romney might have to pay the same taxes as his secretary. Yeah. Having corporations pay their fair share like they did during the Republican Eisenhower administration or the Republican Nixon administration. Oh, we can't have that. Those guys were liberals. No, they were Republicans. Come on. You know what I find so fascinating about this? Actually, so tragic about this is that if you turn on the television and you watch the corporate media, whether it's CNN or MSNBC or CNBC or Fox, those being the cable media, and then, of course, the ABC, CBS, NBC, or even the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, if you turn them on and watch them, you've got, here's the debate. You've got, on the one hand, almost 100 members of Congress elected by millions and millions of people to represent them who've put forward a good, solid plan, the Progressive Caucus's budget plan, that actually balances the budget and would work. And 100% of it is done doing things that have succeeded in the past in the United States. There's nothing new or radical about it. It's just basically going back to pre-Reagan founding principles. So on the one hand, you've got almost 100 elected members of Congress. You would think that they would have credibility. You would think that the media would want to talk to them. They represent we the people. They're members of Congress. They're people you should, capital T, take capital S seriously. And on the other hand, you've got a washed-up former Republican senator, Alan Simpson, and a washed-up former Clinton White House staffer, who, you know, Erskine Bowles, who couldn't even get their own cat food commission to vote in favor of Cat Food Commission Plan 1.0. Nobody should be paying attention to these guys. And there should be a serious debate about what the Progressive Caucus has put forward. I mean, Jan Schakowsky came on this program and laid the damn thing out. It makes perfect sense and it works. And it balances the budget in a decade. And it does so by bringing jobs home and raising pay for people. But it's going to cut those tax loopholes for Mitt Romney and the oil companies. We can't have that. We can't even talk about that. And you will not. So you will not hear a discussion of a debate of the Progressive Caucus. You won't hear it on NPR. You won't hear it on McNeil Lehrer. You won't hear it on ABC, NBC, CBS. You won't hear it on MSNBC, on Fox, or on CNN. You're not going to hear it anywhere. Because it just takes too big of a bite out of the butts of the billionaires and the corporations who made them that way. And that's the real tragedy. Instead, we got these old washed-up shills, Simpson and Bowles.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'll say it again. Roll these guys back to the old folks' home and leave the cat food for the cats. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. One of my favorite quotes, John Kenneth Galbraith, The modern this was back in the 1930s. He said this: the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. Selfishness. Meet Cat Food Commission 2.0. Why is it that all the media, including the government-funded media, NPR and CPB, why is it that they're giving all this press to two guys whose only claim to fame is that they have a speaker's bureau that charges $40,000 every time they stand up in front of a group and give a speech, Simpson and Bowles? That's their job. These guys have not been elected by anybody to do anything. They're retired. Except when they give a speech and make their $40,000 speaking fee. And these guys are all over the media? Okay, issue number one. Issue number two, when are we going to start the war crimes trials? We touched on this yesterday. Now that we know the extent of the involvement in Iraq, and I would add Afghanistan to that, somehow that story in the Washington Post that ran before we started dropping bombs on Afghanistan, where the Taliban formally and publicly said to the world's media, "We, you know, okay, 9/11, if you think Osama bin Laden was behind it, show us some evidence, and we will arrest Osama bin Laden and his merry band." There was only a couple thousand of them in the whole country of Afghanistan, and the Taliban certainly knew where they were, and the Taliban had a lot of guns. "We will arrest them, and we will turn them over to a third country for prosecution." And George W. Bush didn't even respond. Instead, it was like, okay, let's take a country, Afghanistan. Now, I realize there's all kinds of righteous outrage and indignation. Next month is the 10th anniversary of our starting to bomb Iraq based on lies. But, you know, we're in the 11th year, I think, maybe a little bit more, of the war in Afghanistan. I mean, it's longer than World War II. It's longer than the Korean War. It's longer than Vietnam. This is insane. And somehow we've completely forgotten that it could have been avoided. And what Bush did is he took a country that was the poorest country in the world. Actually, it was the second poorest behind North Korea at the time. A GDP of $2 billion. Now, I mean, just to put that in perspective, I mean, that's a gross domestic product. The entire economic activity of the entire country of Afghanistan every year was $2 billion. Now, we've spent, you know, well over $1 trillion there. That's $2,000 billion. We're spending $1 million per soldier per year to put soldiers in there. We're spending all this money on drones and military equipment. We spent, you know, in the first few weeks, we spent $10 or $15 billion taking down a country whose entire annual gross domestic product was $2 billion. The average income in Afghanistan was $300 a year. We could have saved $1 trillion if we had simply said to the Taliban, you know, you guys, you got a country with an annual GDP of $2 billion. We will double your wealth if you'll commit to using at least half of the money to build schools for girls and you know, other, you know, positive things that are going to upgrade the infrastructure of your country and make Afghanistan a better country. And you guys can take the credit for it, because what happens is when you upgrade a country, and particularly when you educate the girls, people like the Taliban, you know, over the next course of the next generation, they lose their power. This is just, I mean, this is like water rolling down a hill. The Taliban is not all that different from the power of the church in the 13th century in Europe. And the Enlightenment came along, and that was the end of that. Excuse me, the Renaissance. As a consequence of the Black Plague, which killed off a third of the Europeans, and so suddenly had a tight labor market and a middle class emerged in Europe. But I digress. So if we had simply said to Afghanistan, "We're going to make you guys rich. Everybody in the country, you know, we're going to double your minimum wage with our money. We'll call it foreign aid. I mean, at that time, we were giving, I believe, about $4 or $5 billion a year to Israel and Egypt, maybe a little more. So, I mean, to get bin Laden, just give us bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda. You guys do the dirty work. Not a single U.S. soldier has to die. And we will give you an amount of money that, you know, the Pentagon spends in a day and doesn't even notice. In fact, we'll give you an amount of money that's a fraction of the $2 trillion that's missing from the Pentagon, period. We can't even figure out where it went. But no, George Bush wanted a war. And so he bombed back to the Stone Age, a country that was already living in stones, literally in houses made of stones. Afghanistan. A country with a $2 billion annual GDP at the time that we invaded them. Now, I realize it's higher now because we're counting all of our economic activity inside that country as GDP. So the CIA factbook now says it's like, what, $10 or $11 billion? Nonsense. Pull us out of there. Take all the military stuff out of there. They're back to they'd probably be a $1 billion GDP now because we've damaged so much of the country. But if we had simply gone in with foreign aid and said, fine, here's the evidence about bin Laden. Please send him to Egypt for a trial. Or Qatar or Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. I don't care. Send him someplace for a trial. We'll agree on it. Here's the information. And by the way, here's a couple $1 billion. Rebuild your country. So that the Taliban, so that the Al-Qaeda will not have another place to have a foothold. I mean, shouldn't we have learned from the Soviets' mistake in Afghanistan? They tried to fight them for a decade and it bankrupted the Soviet Union. We're still there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the net of all this is, when do the war crime trials start? I think next week would be a good place. Four minutes past the hour. Welcome back. So, austerity. Oh, it works so well. You know, the Cat Food Commission is proposing austerity for the United States. Simpson Bowles. Cat Food Commission 2.0. By the way, one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country. And that free signed copy of the book will be sent using stamps.com. That caller could be you, because Shano and his infinite caprice is going to randomly, not so randomly, I don't know, however he does it, he's going to magically divine to whom the book should go, and I'll say so on the air. Anyhow, back to austerity. The Cat Food Commission is back, Simpson Bowles. In fact, the president even referred to them in his speech the other day, which is really tragic. He didn't refer to the Congressional Progressive Caucus. He referred to the Cat Food Commissioners. And, you know, so what does austerity produce? Well, in Bulgaria, catch this. This is from Reuters. Dateline Sofia. That's the city which is the capital of Bulgaria. Bulgaria's government resigned on Wednesday after mass protests against high power prices and falling living standards, joining a long list of European administrations felled by austerity during 4 years of debt crisis. Yeah, and great. That austerity stuff, it's working out really, really well for them. Prime Minister Bulko Borisov, who's kind of an interesting guy. I mean, he used to be the bodyguard to the former dictator of the country, basically. Is that a Ceausescu? Let me look that up. I think it was Bulgaria. It was Ceausescu. Oh, that was Romania. That's right. Thank you, Jim. In any case, I just passed it. Ah, Todor Zhivakov was the dictator. Okay, anyway. So Bulgaria is saying, that's it. No more. They're going to reboot their government. Coming to a country near you? Lance in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Lance.
You're wanting to know when there's going to be a war crimes tribunal?
Yeah.
I think that what would have to happen, first of all, is you'd have to get the village media to even mention it, which they won't do,
right.
and mention it without just dismissing it out of hand. You also might need to have some members of Congress, you know, they have those one-minute speeches you have on the floor before the beginning of every day's House business, come out and say, Mr. President, appoint an independent prosecutor to look into the war crimes perpetrated, and do that every day, have several people do it every day, every time Congress is in session, and hold
yeah.
press conferences. We demand a war crimes tribunal. But I don't think you're going to have much success, because as long as Obama keeps drone lynching people, it's kind of hard to get worked up over Cheney lying a country into war, or Bush having people tortured, or worse, in places like Abu Ghraib. And
well, Obama's at least upfront about it. but, yeah, well, I get it. I think that that's... No, I get your point. We're still committing war crimes, and so we're not going to go back and prosecute previous war criminals. I get it. I'm with you. Lance, Mike in Mike in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey,
hi Tom.
Hey Mike.
I'm a big lefty, but I got to disagree with you. President
right.
Obama put both Simpson and Bowles on this commission.
On the original cat food commission, and they couldn't get their own commission findings passed, and their own commission issued no report. So why is anybody paying any attention to these washed up has-beens?
These guys on the commission.
Obama put them on. You know, I'm not saying Obama's God or walks on water or is perfect. He put them on the commission, but the commission wasn't able to come up with a report. They did nothing. The original cat food commission did nothing. And yes, Obama mentioned them again day before yesterday, which I don't think he should have done. But, you know, if you're calling to say, hey, you know, Obama mentioned them or Obama put them on the commission, therefore, there's no therefore there. Just, you know, Harry in Seattle. Hey, Harry, what's up?
Good day, Tom. I have a question. Did you know that Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld could not leave the United States of America without risking being picked up and taken to The Hague? And what's wrong with this picture? Bradley Manning outs a murderer, all right? And he spends 1,000 days in the clink. Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld are walking around in this country free men.
Right.
Don't tell me there's equal justice under the law in this country. It's a joke.
Yeah, there is not, and it's something that we need to do something about. David in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, David.
Yeah, hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah,
thanks for listening,
you know,
on 950.
And Rachel, you know, Rachel Maddow had her expose on the war, you know, on what you're talking about with the mm-hmm. war crimes and everything that was committed by.
Although
the
she never used that phrase, but yes.
Well, yeah. I didn't see the show, but anyways, it's the same what we have going on with Simpson Bowles, what we have going on with climate change. It's a groupthink mentality that the media has, where, you know, let's cover the South African runner and let's do all this, and we're gonna all cover the same stories because no one can dare step out and, you know, put their head on the line to, you know, it's the groupthink mentality where no one's gonna call for a war crime or even mention it because they don't have the balls to do it.
Yeah. I wouldn't describe it quite that way, but David, I think that that's it's not just groupthink. It's not just conventional wisdom. There's something deeper there. It's that Simpson Bowles are operating in the interests of the billionaires and the corporations. And the billionaires and corporations' interests go a long way in this country. Nick in Hughesville, Maryland. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Welcome to Washington.
Thank you.
Been listening for a little while and really enjoy your show. A lot of insight. I just want to comment.
You're listening on We Act Radio in Maryland. Hey, good on you. Thank you for listening.
They need to crank up the signal a little bit.
Yeah, they're working on it, actually.
the war crimes thing, that really gets me worked up. I mean, when I saw just how we got into Iraq, I guess you got to thank George Bush for that, because I was an apolitical American up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in my 50s now, and I'm quite political now. I'm watching, paying attention.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a lot of people, it was a wake-up call. I mean, there were more people in the streets in the run-up to the Iraq war worldwide, both in the United States and worldwide, than at any other time in the history of America. And somehow that got ignored by and large by the media as well. I mean, our media has failed us, our politicians have failed us, and we can't fail us. We need to be speaking out about this. Thanks a lot for the call, Nick, and thanks for listening to WEAC Radio, our our AM radio affiliate here in Washington, D.C. Jim, in Ashland, Maine, you have you want to talk about the biggest lie that led us into war happened during Vietnam?
Yeah, James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable.
Okay, I haven't read the book.
Get it and read it. The corroborative book is Charles Crenshaw's book, Trauma Room 1.
So what's the lie?
The Central Intelligence Agency shot John Kennedy.
Ah, okay. I just respectfully disagree. I believe it was the mafia. But whether...
Read the book. Read the book. He lays it out real well.
All righty. Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Whatever. Caleb in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Caleb, what's up?
Hey. Couldn't be better. I heard that your book is a pretty darn good book on this thing, too.
Yeah, I would recommend people read Legacy of Secrecy or Ultimate Sacrifice, two books that Lamar Walter and I wrote on the JFK assassination.
Yeah, I've enjoyed your interviews with Lamar on the line. You're not, unfortunately, on the radio here, so I'm loving your podcast and drinking coffee from the Tom Hartman University mugs.
Great. Thank you.
But, you know, every now and then I hear you ask people, please tell me a place that has gotten prosperous through austerity. Has anyone ever come up with such a place?
No, I've never had a positive answer to that question. I mean, there's two questions that I ask constantly of Republicans and conservatives. One is, you know, why did they flip the stars upside down on the GOP logo and turn them into the satanic stars? And the other is, can you identify any – well, actually, three questions. The second is, can you identify any country that's cut its way to prosperity? And the third is, can you identify any country that's ever lived by libertarian principles and been successful? And nobody's got answers to any one of those three.
I certainly hope that you'll keep asking about the austerity one because, you know, that just slides through people's throats, I'm afraid.
Yeah, absolutely. And the president, you know, said you can't cut your way to prosperity. I believe he used that exact phrase or words very close to that. And I've been saying that for a couple of years here on this program. So, Caleb, excellent. Thank you very much for the call. Thanks for your comment. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
This has to do with the whole Alan Simpson Erskine Bowles hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Erskine Bowles, Alan Simpson appeared on PBS, and he said that he was going to win over the American people with humor. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then they started having these hearings. And here's this part of his humor. And it was quoted in the news. So I'll repeat it because it was in the newspaper. But it might be...
Very quickly, please.
But he said, yes. He said, like 310 million calves sucking on one...
Yeah.
It's Social Security.
Yeah.
Now,
teat actually is the word he used. Which is what cows have, and I'm not sure that that's an obscenity that we had to bleep or not. But if it offended somebody, my apologies. But I think. But Frank, you're right. Yeah, and that, you know, some kind of joke, right? Ha ha ha. And that's Alan Simpson. That's how he views it. All of Americans who are getting any kind of government benefit are basically takers. They're moochers. They're leeches. But with the banksters, they're patriots.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But disabled people, poor people, unemployed people, elderly people, let them eat cat food. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Fred in New York City. Hey, Fred, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, Tom, always good to see you on TV, on Free Speech TV and RT. One of the biggest issues we have is there's so many things wrong with our government that it's almost every moment you can pick a different topic. And we really need
to keep me in business.
We're going to focus on these things one at a time and just stick glued to one issue. Like, for instance, they're trying to get rid of the post office right now. I saw some company named Wakona.
Yeah.
Is a partnership for uniforms or something, logo branded stuff that has nothing to do with delivering mail, but it just goes to show you what's going on in the leadership.
Yeah, they're not really trying to get rid of the post office. They're trying to get rid of the postal workers union. That was the you know, the big kahuna, the big, you know, enchilada, whatever. I don't know Spanish.
I'm retired, and what you call a union is just another form of management. That's a paper tiger.
Well, arguably. I mean, actually, there are several unions that make up that represent various postal workers. But the fact of the matter is that the second largest workforce, single employer workforce in the United States, is the post office. Number one is Walmart. Number two is the post office. And the post office is unionized. Virtually all of their workers are unionized. And so the Republican Party put that in their crosshairs a long time ago.
See, there's a little bit of misinformation out there.
I'm listening.
Yeah, not all the workers are unionized.
I didn't say all of them were. I said most of them were.
A lot of times, there's people that are temporary workers.
Right, and you've got some management workers who are not unionized. Yeah, I understand that. But the fact of the matter is that the largest single employer union workforce in America is the post office, with between 600 and 700,000 employees. And the Republican Party, in their war on unions, which was declared by Ronald Reagan when he took office in 1981, this is the big one. Bring this one down, and you know, you
see, the union is not organized into what it's supposed to be. For instance,
well, you know, we could argue that all day long, but the fact of the matter is that these guys are taking down the post office for two reasons. One, they want to destroy a union and unionized workers, and bring everybody, you know, bring down the lowest common denominator. And number two, it makes more money for FedEx and UPS and DHL and, you know, other services like that. And it's pretty straightforward stuff. Fred, thanks for the call. Terry in Alcoa, Tennessee. Hey, Terry. Tax laws should not be called loopholes, really?
Yeah, I think they should just be called tax laws.
Yeah.
Let me say something real quick. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm an American, first off. And patriotic as can be. I study the Constitution constantly, have all my life. I'm 55 years old. And the whole deal with the taxes should be that we shouldn't be filing tax returns. Now, I'm a disabled American. I pay taxes on my disability. But...
And you can thank Ronald Reagan for that. Before the Reagan administration, people did not pay taxes on their Social Security income or their disability income.
I'm not a Reagan fan. But they should stop the whole process of filing taxes and tax people at a flat tax rate.
Why?
I live in Tennessee. We pay 9.25 sales tax. It's pretty high.
Yeah, it is.
But the national economy would be self-sufficient with a 6 cent sales tax at the cash register.
So you want, Terry, people like yourself who earn presumably well under $100,000 a year, you want people who are in the lower middle and even the upper middle income brackets to pay a 7% tax on 100% of their income, and you want people like Mitt Romney to pay less than 1/100 of 1% on his income because he doesn't buy that much stuff. He takes his income and he puts it in a Swiss bank account. I don't understand the logic of that.
No. That's not the complete thing. But what I'm saying is, if the corporations and everybody had to pay 6% or 6 cents on everything they did.
On everything they buy.
Everything they bought, everything they sold.
Well,
they had to pay at cash register 6 cents.
Right. It's a consumption tax. So
yes.
Consumption taxes hit consumers. Mitt Romney
exactly.
is not
and
a large consumer.
My
He's a large
income,
saver.
My total income is around $50,000 a year. We don't live good at all.
Right. And I'll bet you spend pretty much everything that you take in. So that 100% of your income would be subject to that 6%. First of all, a 6% national income tax would not be enough. It would have to be at least 18 or 19%. But that, look at the GDP of the United States right now. The total economic activity in the United States last year was $15 trillion. And, you know, if you want to, I can't break down the math that fast in my head. I'd have to pull out the numbers. But, you know, I've had this debate with flat taxers and sales taxers and all kinds of 6% ain't going to do it. 6% of our of the retail economy. It just is not going to do it. But let's say magically that it did. You're still arguing that people like yourself who spend all the money they get should spend, should pay 100% of the tax, that 6%. But Mitt Romney made 20 million bucks last year, and he probably spent 2 million. So he'd pay 6% on his 2 million, and he'd pay zero on the 18 million that he put in his Swiss bank account. How is that right?
I don't have a problem with people being millionaires.
I don't either. Even but if, how is it right that he pays no taxes whatsoever on the 18 million that he stashes away?
I have a problem with Facebook getting money back.
No, you haven't answered my question, Terry. If you want to go to a national sales tax as your way of funding the country instead of an income tax, how do you answer the fundamental unfairness of a national sales tax, which or consumption tax, which is that consumers pay all of it and savers pay none of it?
Are you always good?
Pardon? You're still in the air, Terry. I don't have an answer to that question, and I've never heard anybody give me an answer that makes any sense to me, and that's why, frankly, I think that saying that we should go to a sales tax is not a good idea. I do think we should have a VAT tax, but that's a whole other argument.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Should women and men get equal pay, or for that matter, equal paid leave? Or should anybody get paid leave? Kay Heimowitz is with us. She's a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, the author of Manning Up. And Twitter is at Kay Heimowitz. And Manhattan-Institute.org is the website. Kay, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. So lay out your argument for me against paid leave for women and men in the event that they have a child or a family emergency or whatever.
It's not that I'm against paid leave. It depends what your policy goal is. If you are trying to increase gender equality, this is not the way to go. Let me explain why I say that. If you look at places like Sweden, France, and then the other Nordic countries as well,
where they have paid leave,
where they have
for both genders,
for leave for both,
yeah.
The result has been to hold women back if they want to go move to the very top. In other words, this is not family leave, maternity leave in particular.
Kate, Norway has more female CEOs. They have more female legislators in the United States as a percentage.
Oh, they have legislators, all right. You in the public sector, you can do it through quotas. In the private sector, when you look at Sweden, and I'm pretty sure at Norway as well, I have more data from Sweden. What you find instead is that women are not doing as well in the private sector as they are in the United States, where there is no required family leave. So economists have tried to look at this and try to figure out, well, what's going on here? After all, we know that Sweden is a place where there's a tremendous dedication to gender equality. And what they have concluded, and this is, you know, these are very reputable economists, not conservatives, and includes, by the way, the World Economic Forum. What they concluded is that women who, if they're taking a year off, are less connected to the workforce and less career-oriented. Sweden is actually very well known for having women working part-time a lot. Their gender gap is a little bit lower than ours, but not by much, and has more to do
could
with...
Could this not be the function of it being a wealthier society?
You'll have to explain a little bit better what you mean.
Well, the standard of living in Sweden for the average Swedish family is higher than the standard of living in the United States. It's, you know, everybody has health insurance. Everybody has, you know, cradle to grave. Everybody has access to health care, early education services, whatever you call it, child care early on. Everybody has a free college, essentially, or very, very inexpensive. Everybody has hospice care and elder care in their old age. There's just a baseline that's quite different there than it is here. So in the United States, you've got more and more families where both the husband and wife have to work. And in many situations, one would choose to work and the other would choose not to. And traditionally over years, that's been the man working and the woman not. And, we can debate the biology or the morality of that, but that's just how we were all raised. I mean, over the last millennia. And so if you've got a country that's wealthier, if there's not the pressure, the economic pressure for women to go into the workplace, might it not make a certain amount of sense that not as many do?
Actually, they have a higher percentage of women working in Sweden than we do here. Not by a lot, but it is more. Women are in the workplace. They tend to be working fewer hours than women here. But again, the question that I was raising and that I intended to elaborate on was that you have to figure out what your policy goal is.
Right.
If it is more equality, more gender equality, then maternity leave, and particularly very generous maternity leave, is not necessarily going to help you.
So what would?
Oh, well, my own view is that there is never going to be absolute gender equality for the simple reason that women are less inclined to want to sacrifice time with time or close relationships with their children.
Isn't that equality that we should be working to create in men?
I think we want, and
couldn't we do that by saying we're going to offer maternity leave to men as well as women?
Oh, we can do that, and of course Sweden has done that, and the results there are very, very interesting. Since the 1970s, they have tried to equalize male and female commitment to children, and they've had a little bit of success. So what they did at first was they instituted parental leave that could be taken by women or men. Well, they kept finding that women were taking all the leave and not men at all. And then at a certain point in the 90s, they instituted a use it or lose it approach. If men did not use the leave, the family would lose it. So that did increase the number of men or the percentage of men who were taking leave. However, the studies that I've seen indicate no real change when it comes to, for instance, taking time off with a sick child. And in terms of the gender gap, the wage gap, that hasn't changed much either.
Very interesting statistics, and it's you're I realize you're putting these in a relatively conservative frame, as it were. Let us not try to equalize these. Am I right?
Well, I think that this is something that people should be given choices about. I don't think it's true. I don't think it's up to the state to say we are going to make you exactly equal.
Right.
We want men and women to do exactly the same things. I don't think women want that necessarily. I certainly see no evidence that.
Well, this is equality of opportunity, is it not? It's opportunity to take time off to be with your kids. That's not enforced equality.
Yeah, okay, that's, if you want to equalize parental leave, that's one thing. But again, I think what you're saying is we're going to insist on doing things this way without really asking people what do they want.
Well, no, what I'm saying is that your question is a bit of a straw man, that you're saying that the reason that we should not have parental leave, both for men and for women, is because it's not producing, more female executives in Sweden. And I would say, if it's the moral thing to do, the right thing to do, that as a society we should be doing it. Whether it produces, some magical outcome that if your policy goal is you know, let's say our policy goal is not to raise the wealth of female executives in big corporations. Our policy goal is to do what's right for society and for our people. If men want to take the leave, they can. If women want to take the leave, they can. What's wrong with that?
I actually don't have a problem with that. I think we do have to recognize that there are certain kinds of trade-offs we have to deal with. We have to question what the effect on small businesses will be. I have a friend that I remember talking to. She has she's in the finance world, but she has her own company, about 7 workers, all of them women. She is completely devoted to trying to advance women. And when I suggested to her or asked her what she thought about having more required leave, she said it would make her life impossible.
Well, a lot of these kind of policies here in the United States and in many European countries as well don't kick in until you've got 50 people in your workforce.
That's true. That is true.
And so, I think is kind of a straw man, too. But Kay Heimowitz, it's a thought-provoking conversation. I appreciate it. Senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, manhattan-institute.org. Thank you for being with us, Kay.
Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So should we in the United States say, yeah, let's give maternity leave to women and to men? Or just not at all? Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Carl in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Yes, Tom. I just wanted to say, based on that last call, that I think as a psychologist, I see a lot of marriages that the women have become too strong and aggressive and those kind of things within the relationship, and the man has become kind of
emasculated.
And I think, you know, with the debates we're having in public, I think men are afraid to speak up that as a risk to sound sexist or something like that. But really, with the staying home with the children and stuff, I've had 3 children, and I know my wife is much more suited for being nurturing and caring, especially right after they're born. If I were to stay home, there wouldn't be really nothing I could do, especially if she's breastfeeding.
Well, this is a point I made earlier during what was the break for some of our listeners, was that, you know, there is this thing of biology that we have to acknowledge, that I'm the father of 3 kids too, and that, you know, Louise actually had these 3 children grow inside her and nurse from her for years, and I just caught them when they came out, and I know that the bond that we have to our kids is different, and I believe it's a consequence of that in part. But that said, nonetheless, as a society, if we want families to be stronger, why not give parents, and parental leave is one of the tools we're going to use to accomplish that, why not give parental leave to both parents? And if they don't both work in the same place, you could even give it to them at the same time and they could be with their kids. I mean, Louise and I had that luxury on a couple of occasions, because we had, you know, we were entrepreneurs. We'd sold a business in one case and had good managers who could take over another in another. And then on the third case, you know, 1 year, Louise ran, we started this travel business in 1983 in Atlanta, and I pretty much started it in 83, 84, and Louise ran it 84, 85, and was so successful that, you know, together we sold it in 86 and moved to Europe and lived off that for a year. I mean, it was great. But I stayed home with the kids, and she went to work every day. And
how old were they when you did that?
Our youngest was probably 4, maybe 3.
So a dad can handle them at that point.
And our oldest was probably 12. So, you know, I mean, none of them were nursing any longer, but, you know, I get that. And that was my point. I think that we need to acknowledge biology, but at the same time, shouldn't we be looking at a variety of things that we can do as a society to make us a more humane society, to make us a more egalitarian society? I didn't feel emasculated by being the guy who stayed at home, you know, watching the kids for a year, although I was doing a lot of writing during that year that I was home.
In fact, the kids would make jokes about
it. It's not maternity, though. That's just more, you know, a decision you make later on in life. You know?
Well, it was a decision we were very fortunate to be able to make. You know, we were doing well, but. If we weren't, I mean, if I hadn't been an entrepreneur, it would not be a decision that I could make. If we were both working at Walmart or something, you know, we would have been both working, and our kids would have been like that 50% of American children who come home from school to an empty house right now, which I think is just a shame. I think it's a crime.
All I know is I see a lot of, you know, role reversals and the resentment it causes and the desire to undo it in marriages because society, especially if you look at the media, you see the man as a dork. The man is running around like an idiot, and the woman has it all together, and the man is the doofus.
Well, I've seen that in some of our sitcoms, and I think it's kind of a reaction to, you know, To the Moon, Alice with Jackie Gleason or Archie Bunker, you know, Shut Up, Edith. You know, we've played both sides of that, and I think that those kind of things go in cycles. And I think that you can find shows where the women are docile and the men are strong and vice versa. I'm not willing to paint our entire media with this broad brush. But Carl, I get your point. Thank you for the thoughtful call on this. Hope in Nine Mile Falls, Washington. Hey Hope, thanks for listening to iHeartRadio.
What's up? Real quick, I'm just going to respond to actually the last caller when he said that most men are doofuses. And I think if most men were given the opportunity to be in the home with their children more often, they would probably have the experiences that would lend them to not be doofuses.
Might be. I think there's...
Response,
go ahead.
In response to the woman you had on, and I'm really thankful that you brought up the point, equal opportunity. Just because women are more apt to take the opportunity to be with their children doesn't mean men shouldn't be offered the same opportunity.
Right.
My husband took it. Granted, he was actually getting paid leave to do so, and maybe some families don't have that opportunity.
That's what they do in Sweden.
Because it's not paid. But he stayed home for 6 weeks when our last child was born.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't go back to work in the meantime like some of the other fathers did. They couldn't take it anymore. And I was perfectly capable of taking the full responsibility of our daughter, and he wanted to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he should have had the opportunity, regardless of whether or not it was paid leave.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is women should have the opportunity to become CEOs if they want to, and if they choose not to, that's fine. We shouldn't be trying to social engineer in a way, and Kay's, what I say is a straw man argument, the Conservative Institute's, you know, straw man argument is that we're trying to achieve equal outcomes. I don't think you can ever do that. But what we do have to do is establish equal opportunities.
And my husband, Vaughn, would have been more than happy to be home with our children in order for me to do so.
Yeah.
And you have the opportunity.
And you know, God bless him and you and his employer in particular. And this is something that, you know, in Sweden and in Norway, the companies have to pay people. You know, it's paid maternity leave. So, Hope, thank you for the call. And thank you for listening there in Nine Mile Falls, Washington. And we will be back with more. This war crimes trials, the impending crash, the sequester, John Boehner getting 99% of what he wanted, but all of a sudden he doesn't want it anymore. What's going on? We got a lot to talk about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can pick up the free Tom Hartman app over at the App Store, TomHartman.com, or the App Store. Just check it out. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And this is very interesting. Doug in St. Peter's, Missouri, listening on our app. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Tom, love your show. Third time I've gotten through to you. The more I heard that woman, the more ticked off I got. Because she has one viewpoint, Manhattan Institute, these think tanks, thanks to the Powell Amendment, they're myopic. All they see is business, business, business. Whatever is good for the business. If businesses could get away with it here, they'd have nothing but Foxconns. We'd be working 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, making squat.
Right, which is what the United States was like between the 1870s and 1900.
Exactly. We've come a long way. And as far as, I don't know her situation, but I know people would say, well, you know, why don't you have somebody, your mom, come in and babysit and help out during this time. My mom is dead. I have no family within 800 miles of where I'm at. And, you know, she gives no context. I believe people who are really wealthy and who have money handed to them by their family have a whole different outlook than somebody who has nobody out there, who's had to earn every dime on their own. And when I took care of my kids for 6 weeks, both of them, and then I went back to work. And that was some of the best time I had for bonding with them. I changed diapers. I released stress on my wife. On the second one, she had some postpartum depression. Thankfully, I was there. You know, I just wonder what kind of reality these folks live in.
Yeah. Well, and this is why I was saying that the argument that the Manhattan Institute is putting out, that we shouldn't offer maternity leave to men and women in the United States, in fact, we shouldn't offer it to anybody, is because it didn't succeed in producing equal outcomes for women in terms of becoming CEOs or having pay in Sweden. And my point is, so what? It's the right thing to do. You work for equal outcomes in some cases. This may or may not be one of those cases where you do. Frankly, I think, you know, probably one of the strongest ways to produce equal outcomes is to decide what are the outcomes you want to measure. But that's a whole other argument. But everybody should have an equal opportunity. And you said it very, very well, Doug, and thank you for the call, and thanks for pointing that out. Alexandra in Spokane. Hey, Alexandra, you wanted to talk about equal opportunity.
I do, and I think that you have it right, that equal opportunity for family leave for both men and women comes down to allowing them to make their own decisions for their own family.
Right, which is supposed to be a conservative value, right? Choice?
Correct. So what I'm frustrated with is the tit-for-tat mindset that I hear in so many of these people, like the gentleman who said, fine, you know, stop letting men in the military and send all the women until they've done just as much. Mm-hmm. This isn't about going back in time and making it a competition. This is about starting today, doing the right thing for our fellow American citizens, whether they are male or female, whether they want to stay home or whether they want to work.
And by the way, if you want to produce equal outcome, I mean, if that's one of the goals of policies like this, we're talking about major social change. You're probably not going to see the consequences of this for a generation or two.
Or two, at least, yes.
I mean, it was the World War II, basically, was the you know, push women into the workplace or allowed women into the workplace, your choice of verbs, in the 1940s, that arguably led to an awful lot of rights for the women in the 50s, 60s, 70s as the women's rights movement grew and, you know, brought us to today where you've got, you know, women actually exceeding men in terms of educational outcome and catching up with men slowly. They're still, you know, 78 cents to the dollar, but catching up with men in terms of income in the workplace. And so it's taken three generations.
Right.
And these things don't happen overnight. We're talking about, you know, people, the way people are raised. It's like the attitude toward gays or the attitude toward segregation and integration. It's, you know, now finally we've got a generation of young people in their 20s who don't give a rat's patootie if somebody is gay or straight or whether they're black or white, which was not true of the generation that preceded them. They were slightly more egalitarian. And was definitely not true of the generation that preceded them, my generation, which was, you know, sort of half and half, and definitely not true of my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation, where bigotry was the norm and celebrated. So, you know, things change
over time. We need to put the mechanism in place to allow for that growth to happen in the area of who cares for the kids.
Yeah, there you go. I'm with you. Alexander, thank you for the call. Mac in Kanahoi. Tell me how to say it in Hawaii there, Mac.
Kaneohe.
Kaneohe, okay.
Kaneohe, Hawaii, yeah.
Hawaii.
Tom, I'm kind of redundant to the people who just called and your comments. The problem isn't how many women and what percentage of the executive workforce are women, but rather what is the access they have, and I think that's the issue that we haven't addressed. Plus, I don't know how we go about measuring what the opportunities and accesses are.
Right.
Our tendency is to measure in huge quantities rather than the process.
Right.
Tell me how we can measure the process. I don't know how. Maybe somebody else knows.
But it's a matter of opportunity. And this is, I mean, you know, one of the conservative arguments against free college being available to people and the in favor of privatizing colleges, making them a profit center, and supporting what has happened since Reagan became president. In 1980, when Reagan was elected, about 80% of the cost of all college tuition in the United States was picked up by governments, state, local, federal. And about 20% was tuition. Now those numbers are pretty much reversed. About 23% is picked up by state, federal, and local governments, and about 77% is picked up by tuition. And conservatives say, well, that's because, you know, everybody doesn't want to go to college. So why should we offer college to everybody? Because everybody doesn't want to go to college. There's some people who are not suited to go to college. Well, of course, everybody doesn't want to go to college. Everybody isn't suited to college. That doesn't mean you shouldn't make it available to everybody. And I would add trade schools as well.
Right, right. Post-secondary education. I think you have the point. The point is let's start looking at the locks and the keys to those locks.
Yes.
And one of those keys is Obama's push for education. You know, the investment in that next generation that they can progress.
Yeah, it is really all about the locks and the keys. Very well said, Mac. Thanks a lot. Brenda in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Brenda.
Oh, good afternoon. I wanted to call and ask if you, I just started listening to you last week.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I wanted to, and one of the interviews that you had last Thursday brought to my mind, I was wondering if you've ever interviewed Chris Mooney and his book,
The Republican Brain. Yes,
yeah.
We did.
Have you ever?
Yeah, when the book
you
came
have.
Out.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
Well, that interview really brought it to me. I mean, I have found that book so useful because you kept trying to rationally talk to him.
Oh, last week, the Republican.
Rational.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. And it's a different way of thinking. It's in fact, you're probably going to hear the same thing in another 15 minutes when Cliff May comes on. A neoconservative who still supports the war in Iraq. And we're going to have an interesting conversation. I hope. We'll see. But I think you're right. I think that there's a difference in brain wiring. And then the step beyond that is John Dean, who's been a guest on this program many, many times over the years, who the former lawyer for Richard Nixon, White House counsel, who wrote a book called Conservatives Without a Conscience, which is about the sociopaths within the conservative market, movement. And that's like the edge of it, the extreme leading edge. But yeah, excellent point, Brenda. Thank you for the call and thanks for listening to the program. Joe in Skokie, Illinois. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Sorry. I'm running to get the kids because I'm a full-time stay-at-home dad. My
Good
wife
on you.
Works. Thank you. And, you know, it's gotta be equal. It's gotta be equal leave opportunity for both parents. Because in this day and age, it's so different. The earning potential of people coming out of school, coming out of life, you never know what it's going to be. And then the kids come along, and you have to make the arrangements and make the adjustments that are needed.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
no,
to make things work, and it should be available to everybody.
It's true.
Or at least have that option.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, that year that I stayed at home, it was because our business was growing through that phase where we were becoming a multi-million dollar company and it needed good management. And I'm a lousy manager. I'm a very good entrepreneur. I know how to start businesses. I know how to do sales. I know how to, you know, come up with ideas. But Louise is a brilliant manager. She's the manager of this program. She's the manager of this small business. She handles all the money. She makes all the basic business decisions. She manages all the employees. She's good at it. And so I stayed home, and she managed this travel business as it grew. But I helped put it on the map. So it's
I had a small construction company. It did very well. But my wife was an attorney for a Fortune 500 company, and it made more sense.
Yeah. Yeah, it just makes more sense. So people should be free to make those decisions, even if everybody doesn't make those decisions. And that's where I say that the Manhattan Institute's argument that, well, all these women are not making this decision to climb in the workplace, or men are not making the decision to stay at home with their kids in large numbers, or, you know, or 50-50. That's no reason not to offer it. Thank you, Chip.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know, this is a point that has been made so many times, but even in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, it's about opportunity, not outcome. One of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country. Free signed copy of that book of Rebooting the American Dream will be sent using stamps.com, and that caller could be you. We shall see. Anthony in Watsonville, California. Anthony, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Mr. Hartman. Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question about our economy, and my thing is, most people have to budget their money, and the government seems to never publicize where they put the money. So my thing is, the average person doesn't understand this fiscal cliff simply because where's the money go? We're paying money on, I'm nervous, sorry.
That's quite all right.
We're paying money on old money borrowed for these two wars, and but they, all they hear is, oh, too much money is going to Social Security. Too much money is going to health care.
Yeah. Anthony, all the money that's going to Social Security and health care and all the other so-called entitlement programs is all completely transparent. The federal budget is published. You can read it. There are areas that are called black areas. You can't read the details of the budget of the Central Intelligence Agency or the National Security Agency or the Defense Intelligence Agency. Or I think any of the 16 or 17 intelligence agencies that we have, but they're a relatively small part of the budget. The Pentagon budget is a lot more opaque, although we do have a fair amount of detail in the Pentagon budget. They do submit a budget every year. The problem is that they've never been audited and their budget is off by $2 trillion. And they can't account for that money, where that money went. And it's literally $2 trillion missing. It's not a surplus. But other than that, most of our budget is pretty obvious. We, you know, we spend about half of our discretionary budget on defense, and well, I don't have the pie chart in front of me, so I'm not going to go through it all. But people should look at these breakouts and see where their money is going. I don't think that there's, frankly, very much waste in our government. I think that there's a fair amount of fraud in our defense budget, and some waste, fraud, and abuse there. And you know, probably there are other areas that could be more efficient, but it is available. Anthony, thanks for the call. Bob in Reading, Massachusetts. Hey, Bob.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I have a comment on your guest from the Manhattan Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Her argument seemed to be that when Sweden instituted family leave, that we didn't wind up with more women executives in Sweden.
Right.
Seems to me that that wouldn't have been the point of instituting family leave.
That was my point, that's a straw man argument, that the metric, if that's the, she said, and she was, you know, fairly open about it, she said, if your goal is to create equal outcome in the workplace between men and women, this is not the way to do it. And I'm like, duh. You know, but that wasn't the goal. The goal was to create a more egalitarian society, a better place to live.
Right. Yeah. She's measuring the wrong thing, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. She's using the wrong metric, or she's giving an answer to a question that wasn't being asked. Or if it was asked, the answer, you know, if the Swedes did start, as Kay was implying, if not outright saying, if they did start equal paid family leave for men and women because they wanted to help women have equal opportunities in the workplace, and it didn't produce that outcome, then so what? You know, if it produces the outcome of a higher quality of life, of better families, of more solid families, of lower divorce rates, of healthier, mentally healthier children, physically healthier for that matter,
It's similar to your observation of conservatives where, you know, they always try to state that the American dream is to be a billionaire.
Right.
And your position is the American dream is to have a, you know, a good, successful, happy family life and a comfortable retirement.
Yeah, it's my dad.
Yeah. And so what Sweden did was more in that line.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It was the, and we now have to call it the European dream because it's only a dream for most Americans, and it's actually the life of most, at least Northern Europeans. Bob, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Fenwick in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Hey, Fenwick, what's up?
Tom, my wife had to go back to work when our son was 3 months old.
Wow.
And what I was able to do for him was to give him bottles of warmed-up breast milk that my wife had pumped, or formula, later baby food in jars, change his diaper many times a day, dress him, take him around places and show him stuff and tell him about things, and he turned out pretty well.
That's great. That's great. And so, you know, it's possible. And the argument isn't that we're trying to equalize outcome in the workplace. The argument is what's better for the family, what's better for the kids, what's better for society as a whole. In that regard, I think Sweden is way, way ahead of us. Fenwick, thank you for sharing your story with us. Jerry in Galway, New York. Hey, Jerry.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you, Jerry?
Oh, pretty good.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk about, I had a thing about Congress that maybe they should try to do a little bit more, and they should work together, and they should get committees and actually get results.
Yeah.
That way we could get the sequestration and everything else.
Yeah, I think that would be very, very nice, Jerry. And the problem is that you've got a Republican Party that is committed to one thing and one thing only, and that is absolute power. They want complete control of the United States so that they can hand it over to their billionaire buddies and cronies and funders. And if taking down the middle class in America is the price that they have to pay for that power, they're quite willing to do it. They are quite willing to see the, you know, the economy go in the tank in exchange for people, in the hopes that people will blame that on the president and on the Democrats. And thus they can, you know, crow about it and take credit for it. I think President Obama is short-circuiting their efforts and their plans by pointing out, you know, for example, the outcome of the sequester. And now you've got, you know, John Boehner a year ago when he put into place the sequester was bragging he got 98% of what he wanted. And now he's squealing that it's the Obama sequester. It's not working out so well for them. But this was their plan. And this was their plan for the first 4 years of the Obama presidency. And, you know, you'll remember going up to the election, many of us hoped that if he won re-election, the Republicans would not try this strategy again, because why bother? Well, they're trying it again. This is exactly what they're doing. So, Jerry, I share your dream for an America that works. Would that it be? So we'll be back. Thank you for the call. Cliff May coming up next, one of the original neocons, talking about the Iraq War. Stick around.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And it is next month, 10 years since the invasion of Iraq. Time for some perspective, for some retrospective, for consideration about what it means to the United States and what it meant to the people of Iraq. Cliff May is on the line with us. He is the president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The website is defenddemocracy.org, and a spiffy website it is, Fighting Terrorism and Promoting Freedom, the subtitle. And former director of communications for the RNC, member of the Project for the New American Century, Council on Foreign Relations, and the original neocon. Cliff, welcome back to the program.
That's good. Your that biography is not entirely correct.
Okay, so what's wrong?
I was never a member of PNAC, and I was never a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Other than that, I think you got it pretty good.
Oh, okay. I got those off Wikipedia.
I was a New York Times foreign correspondent for the longest period of my life, except for being here, just so you know.
Okay. You should get your Wikipedia page edited. Well, maybe somebody.
It's a constant pruning job. People are always putting things there that.
Yeah.
Thanks for letting me know. That must have gone up since the last time we looked.
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. I look at my page every 6 months or so, and there's always something new on there that's like, well, where did that come from?
I do know Bill Kristol. I've had drinks with him, but I was never part of PNAC.
Yeah. Okay. But, you know, PNAC was in 1998. back when you were working for the RNC, if that's true, PNAC was calling on President Clinton to invade Iraq, and this letter that was signed by Wolfowitz and Feith and Jeb Bush and Don Rumsfeld and whatnot. In retrospect, wasn't this a horrible mistake, invading Iraq, particularly given that they had nothing to do with 9/11?
Well, let's understand and try to remember that the reasons we went into Iraq back then had to do with Saddam Hussein and the danger he was believed to pose in terms of the weapons of mass destruction that every intelligence agency believed he was not only had developed but was stockpiling.
But no, they didn't.
No, they didn't what?
They didn't believe that. I mean, we had weapons inspectors on this program before we went into war, and they were saying, no, there's no evidence. The UN was saying there's no evidence.
Let me refresh your memory just a little bit here. Senator Hillary Clinton put it this way. In the 4 years since the inspectors left, intelligence reports show that Saddam Hussein has worked to rebuild his chemical and biological weapons stock.
Right, intelligence reports that were cooked. I mean, Hillary Clinton was admitting that she had been lied to.
Well, she hadn't. Well,
isn't this a horror cliff? I mean, aren't we looking at something like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution here?
No, I don't think so, and I don't think you have any evidence to suggest that. But if you're saying that Hillary Clinton was brainwashed, or if you're saying the intelligence,
I'm saying she was lied to.
Huh?
I'm saying she was lied to.
Whom?
By Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith, principally, and Don Rumsfeld.
Did they prepare the intelligence reports, or did the CIA prepare the reports?
Well, according to the people inside the CIA, Dick Cheney was down there, and Don Rumsfeld were down there on a fairly regular basis demanding particular types of intelligence.
That's actually not the case. But you're saying that if it were the case, you're saying that the CIA said, well, if Dick Cheney wants us to put out certain kinds of intelligence, we just have to do that.
And I'm saying that they cherry-picked what they wanted out of it.
Not talking about Dick Cheney's cherry. She's talking about intelligence reports. Let me also
sure.
Former Vice President Al Gore claimed the following. We know, he said, we know that Saddam Hussein has stored secret supplies of biological and chemical weapons throughout his country. Gore added, Iraq's search for weapons of mass destruction has proven impossible to deter, and we should assume that it will continue for
Cliff, let me get this right. You're saying that the reason why 4,000 dead Americans, $3 trillion, 30,000 wounded Americans, 108,000 dead Iraqis, 15 million displaced Iraqis, the reason that all of that is a good thing is because a couple of Democrats believe flawed intelligence?
I'm not saying any of that. What I am saying is that Senator Kennedy, I can give you a quote from him. He says, we have known for many years.
You can quote Democrats all day long, Cliff. They were wrong.
What I'm saying is that there was bipartisan consensus that Saddam Hussein represented a very grave national security.
And it's a consensus that was being driven by the Bush administration that was committed. I mean, George Bush told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, in 1999, when they were writing a charge to keep, Mickey Herskowitz was ghostwriting it for the Bush family. Bush told him if he ever became president, he wouldn't make the mistake his father did and get out of Iraq, not go all the way to Baghdad and get out of Iraq before an election. He would have a real war and use the political capital to privatize Social Security.
What he believed was that Saddam Hussein represented a threat, and there was bipartisan agreement on that, and that bipartisan agreement was the reason we went into Iraq and brought down.
I remember Robert Byrd standing on the floor of the Senate talking about how this was Vietnam all over again, and we were being lied to.
Gosh, how come he was so smart, Robert Byrd, and how come Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, they were all so stupid? Is that what you think, that they couldn't see the difference?
I don't know.
Look,
what I do know is that we were lied into a war, and I'm astounded that you're...
You don't know that at all. You have no evidence of that whatsoever. You can say that the intelligence community, and it wasn't just the American intelligence community, misunderstood how much...
There was no meeting with Mohammed Atta in Prague, and the guy that the CIA had hired to check into that meeting said at the time, yeah, that's not Mohammed Atta. And then Bush comes out and says, or Cheney comes out on Meet the Press 3 months later and says, oh, yeah, it was Mohammed Atta. You know, and this guy's yelling at the TV and throwing his shoe at the TV.
We did not go into Iraq because of Mohammed Atta.
There was,
I haven't said it was a good idea to go in. What I've said was that it was bipartisan agreement, substantial bipartisan agreement, that Saddam Hussein represented as the threat that needed to be dealt with.
So you want to make, is the subtext of your argument, I've been trying to figure this out. At first I thought the subtext of your argument was Democrats liked it so it was okay, but it sounds more and more like what you're saying is, don't blame it on Republicans, especially if you're going to have war crimes trials, because there were Democrats who voted for this thing, too.
No, there's no subtext except to say that that it's important to get history right as opposed to spinning history in a partisan and ideological fashion.
That's so is the history that this was a good idea or a wrong idea?
The fact of the matter is that Saddam Hussein was seen as a threat to America's national
security. But he was not.
And he may not have been nearly the kind of threat he was appearing.
Cliff, I see over on your website at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, defenddemocracy.org, what I thought was really interesting, you're going after the dinar, the Iranian dinar. What do you think about the theory that has been floated for years? I mean, I actually had people talking about this on this program back in 2003, that Ahmad Chalabi was actually an agent of Iran, that the Iranians had the most, you know, who had the most to win taking out Saddam Hussein? Saddam Hussein had killed 1 million Iranians in the Iraq-Iran war. And the Iranians now, I mean, what was the first business to open in Baghdad? It was the Bank of Iran, you know, it was the Bank of Tehran. And that Chalabi was an Iranian agent, and that George W. Bush and the Bush administration were completely duped by the Iranians and did exactly what the Iranians wanted. What do you think?
Look, I think that right now the Iranians see a big opportunity to essentially make Iraq into a satrapy, to make it into a colony, and that would be a very bad thing.
But what if that was their original plan and Chalabi was their guy?
And
the Bush administration just got duped into it.
Who duped them into it?
The Iranians.
So the Iranians duped the Bush administration and the Bush administration
into taking out Saddam.
Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and Kennedy.
That's sure.
Your view of history is that everybody has been duped except you, of course.
Well, I was asking your opinion of it, actually.
If you want my opinion, you got to give me a little time to talk about it.
Well, we've got 20 seconds left, Cliff. I'm sorry.
My opinion is that at the time that Saddam Hussein was taken down, there was good reason, based on the intelligence we had, which was largely faulty, to do so. I think the fact that we have also left there as quickly as we did makes it very problematic, because Iran may end up in historically benefiting from this. Right now, Iraq is not the worst place in the Middle East, but I'm very concerned about it for the future.
Yeah. Okay. I don't disagree with at least the last part of that analysis.
We agree on more than you think if you give it time to explain.
Yeah, and I think that Iran is going to exploit this and it has been the primary benefactor of it. Cliff May, defenddemocracies.org. Thanks, Cliff.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Well, the neoconservatives are still defending the war in Iraq. What do you think? Twenty minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. And Jim in Deerfield, Mass. Hey, Jim, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, for taking the call. I just wanted to affirm what you were saying earlier. This was not a case of bad intelligence. Saying that, of course, gives these guys such a pass, and I followed all of this very closely at the time, that the intelligence was always cherry-picked. In fact, when they say that, well, this agency and that agency, intelligence agency, supported this notion that whatever curveball was spinning, that's not quite true. There were a lot of intelligence operatives, professional careerists in the intelligence agencies who were looking at curveballs baloney, saying that it was precisely that.
Yep, and always had been, by the way.
Another thing is that I believe that Hillary Clinton's decision to support the war was more of a political calculation.
Oh, of course.
I think that she didn't want to appear too dovish.
She didn't want to be George McGovern. She knew that she was going to run for president someday, and she did not want to be George McGovern.
Exactly. But what really riles me up is this notion that the intelligence was bad. I mean, that is such a shame.
But really, you know, apropos of Hillary, in defense of Hillary, the political dialogue should never have reached the point where it was where voting against a war would make you seem something less than patriotic. And that's what that's how the Republicans had framed this. The very same Republican Party that fought Roosevelt for the better part of 4 years about going into World War II or intervening in Europe, shall we say. The very same Republican Party who fought Woodrow Wilson about intervening in World War I. The very same Republican Party whose standard bearer in 1952, Dwight Eisenhower, ran on a platform of vote for peace, vote for Eisenhower. We played the clip for you yesterday. I can play it again in just a second. And this is the Republican Party that somehow had morphed into such a war-hungry party that and it succeeded in convincing the American people that if you weren't for war, well, here, this is how Eisenhower ran for president in 1952.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. A paid film.
There you go. And in fact, by the way, you know, one of the fellows who was one of those intelligence analysts is going to be on our TV show tonight. Somehow this Republican Party had created this zeitgeist, the spirit of the times where people felt that if they didn't vote for war, they would be called out as being, doves. And that was a bad thing. And that's a tragedy in and of itself, Jim.
It is, exactly. And it never should have gotten to that point. So it was so far to that point, in fact, that we had Judy Miller spinning this on the front page of the New York Times, of all places, to that effect.
Yeah, and this was one of those moments where you yell at the TV when Rachel did her special on hubris, and they showed the New York Times article, and they brought it out full screen. And there on the byline was by so-and-so and Judith Miller. And I'm like, yes, please say that out loud. No, didn't happen. Jim, thank you for the call. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
I think you just covered the point I was going to make. I remember when the war was happening, either you were with us or against us.
Yep.
This country was on a war footing, and it was also based on the progress. Well, the 100 years, the next thing after the Cold War ended, they were going to establish democracy in Iraq and other places, and those were a lot of the underpinning. So, you're right. A political calculation was made because, after all, the Democrats don't own defense, supposedly, in the minds of the people, right? Where the Democrats are the anti-defense people. So they couldn't very well be sensible, I think.
Well, the old Republicans, I mean, my deceased father was, a Republican who, when he was 17, he went off to fight in World War II, and it ended before he got out of boot camp. But, he was of that generation. And he always referred to the Democrats as the war party. He World War I and World War II were the Democrat wars. Vietnam was a Democrat war. I mean, he was like, my dad was, he wasn't a pacifist. I mean, he volunteered to go after World War II, but he thought that war was, stupid unless you'd been invaded. And somehow that's gotten flipped on its head by modern day Republicans.
Tom sort of carries forward now. I mean, we have wars going on right now, and no one seems to care. I mean, we have people in Afghanistan. They don't even show the dead people. The country, it's all like it's got to be 5 minutes on TV. We have to have a bomb exploding and, go take out the reactor, send a bomb over. I mean,
right. And God forbid an athlete in South Africa should shoot his girlfriend through the door of the bathroom. And she's cute and looks great in a swimsuit, so we can put all kinds of pictures all over TV. I mean, it's like, we've got serious media dysfunction syndrome here in the United States. Something for which there's not a medication.
Precisely.
Yeah. Richard, thanks a lot.
And there was a lot of bad intel, too. The guys like rewriting history. This is what they all do.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. Richard, thank you for the call. Alan in Muskegon, Michigan. Hey, Alan, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tom. Thank you. I've been listening to all that's been going on today, or a good part of it anyway. And I started thinking about what it is about this new Republican Party that makes them think the way they do. You brought this up before, but I think it has to do with a fundamental view of human nature where evil is the norm and must be controlled by those who are smarter and more powerful.
And yes. This is Thomas Hobbes' worldview.
Yeah, it carries through to everything they do, though. When you talked about why it is that we have college students, you know, paying huge amounts for their education, you know, and I don't know how often you've mentioned it, but, you know, in many countries in the world, in the developed world, university education is a given.
Yep.
It is covered by the
it's free.
The government. But anyway, you know, getting back to the Republican thinking, everything is cost equals value.
Right. And in the real world, value actually very often can't even be measured with dollars. Excellent point, Alan. Thank you for calling and making it. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one of our callers today is going to get a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country. In fact, we're going to send him a hardcover. The bad and the very, very argillaciously ugly, the good. The people of Bulgaria, after years of crippling austerity that has taken the unemployment rate to nearly 12%, the people of Bulgaria rose up and said they're finished with the conservative austerity regime. And after days of anti-austerity protests rocking their country, the pro-austerity Bulgarian government formally resigned and called for new elections. As the outgoing prime minister said, I can't watch as fences go up around the parliament. People want the government to resign, then the state needs a new vote of confidence so the people will decide how the government continues from now on. This is how organized people take down the banksters, and we should be paying attention here in the United States. The bad. Alcohol. Don't freak out. I'm not going to take your drinks away, but a new report out of the Boston University School of Medicine shows that alcohol causes 20,000 cancer-related deaths in the United States every year. In fact, the report argues that alcohol is behind nearly 4% of all cancer deaths in America. $250 million is sucked out of our economy each year as a result of alcohol-associated health expenditures. Clearly, this is a dangerous drug. I don't want to outlaw it. I just want our lawmakers to recognize how dangerous it is and how safe marijuana is compared to it, and then come to their senses and legalize and regulate marijuana in the same way alcohol is. Capiche? It's about time to end Richard Nixon's failed drug war. And the very, very ugly Missouri State Representative Mike Lehrer. Nobody wants to protect the gun industry more than Lehrer does, so he introduced legislation in the Missouri Assembly making it a felony to even introduce any new gun safety laws. Again, that's a felony just to introduce particular legislation. Here's the best part. Lehrer doesn't think his own bill will pass. But as he told Talking Points Memo, he introduced it anyway to make a point about freedom. Right, because nothing says freedom like making it illegal to even bring up a debate about measures to increase gun safety. That is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Amazing. Bob in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I got a possibly complicated question, so stick with me here. And I hope David Korn or somebody like that's listening. I'm just wondering, with all the deaths in Iraq, I believe it's public information about how they died. I'm not sure how hard it is to get it, but I'm really curious as to how many troops died while on a specific mission looking for WMDs and were hit by IEDs somewhere. Because I know they tortured, you know, people in Afghanistan that said, you know, Saddam was meeting with bin Laden and these other people about bomb making and Al-Qaeda and all this stuff. And I'm just wondering, is there any way of knowing how many troops died specifically based on bad intel torture?
I think you could arguably say, in fact, I wouldn't even say arguably, Bob, it was in 2006 or 2007 that the our weapons inspector, I'm forgetting his name now, it was the guy who followed Scott Ritter. Was it Hans somebody? Yeah, whatever his name was. We had him on this program a couple of times. That he came back and they did this official report. Now the Hans guy was the UN guy, but our official weapons inspector, the guy with the real thin face and the mustache and the brown hair. Anyhow, he came back and he said there are no WMDs in Iraq. We have searched the country from one end to another. Officially, the official position of the Bush administration is that there are no WMDs in Iraq. And that was the point, arguably, at which every soldier in Iraq was no longer there looking for WMDs. And up to that point, you could make a case that you could make a point that up until that point in time, every soldier in Iraq was there because they were looking for WMD, even if what they happened to be doing in the process was, you know, securing a city or kicking in doors or whatever. So I think that you could just take that point in time and say how many people died before that point in time.
Yeah, that is true. I'd just be really curious as to how many were on specific, you know, like they got the intel, they sent it out to the generals, and they said, okay, we got to go to grid G2 because we got some intel, you know, our enhanced interrogation.
Yeah, it's
one more thing. Remember, Dick.
If it was more than one, it was a crime.
Right. And the Judith Miller articles. I believe Dick Cheney was the source for those, and he would leak this bad intel to her, and then he'd go out and meet the press. He's like, "Hey, it's not just me; it's the New York Times."
Right. He would leak the He would leak bad intel to Judy Miller, and then he would. You're absolutely right. And then he'd go on TV and say, "Hey, look at the New York Times said it." You are absolutely right, Bob. And Judy Miller bears I suspect a very heavy burden in this, whether she was duped into it, whether she, you know, believed it. She's going to have to tell her own story. I don't know. But, she was a major player in making that story, bringing that story to the United States. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say in a discussion between Scott Shane, who is the national security reporter for The New York Times, and Clifford May, I really take exception with his attitude towards dissent in Iran. He just seemed to think, well, you know, it's not a democracy, therefore we have the right to go in and do whatever we want. We can get entangled, we can bomb them.
Iran is the next country in the crosshairs of the neocons. They're pretty upfront about it.
And the problem with that is that there's quite a bit of dissent in the country. Wouldn't it be better, and this is what I argued between, you know, in this discussion, I said, well, wouldn't it be better to support the dissent, and rather than galvanize, you know, all of the conservative forces, which is what exactly you would do if you go in and you start saber rattling and whatnot.
Or if you start a war.
And he just, you know, had such an arrogant attitude, I thought. I mean, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to share that.
Well, I think it's a brilliant observation.
And I just wanted to say also, you know, you had mentioned last week that National Public Radio does now use a lot of conservative think tanks. And he is, a good example of a conservative think tank. And Minnesota Public Radio doesn't think that it's important to announce that, you know, to say, well, this person represents, a conservative opinion, because after all, their listeners are just so intelligent, they will know that anyway. And I thought that was very, I mean, this is my opinion again, but I thought that's not very good journalism. I think you need to explain exactly what's going on and not leave it up to, you should just let people know.
Yeah, I actually had to turn NPR off earlier in the week when they had, or last week they had a guy from Cato on talking about, Medicare. It was like, okay, I'm not going to yell at the radio. I am going to turn it off. John, Shano tells me that he has decided that you are the guy who's going to get a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country by Tom Hartman. First edition hardcover, in fact, autographed by me. So I'm putting you on hold. John is on line two. He's on line two. So, Danielle, you can pick that up. Jim, is it Raton, New Mexico?
Raton.
Okay. Jim, you're on the air. What's up?
I'm curious why a group of wives, parents, children with enough backing, why couldn't someone start a civil case against the administration?
Because you can't sue the government unless the government gives you permission to sue them.
Okay.
Yeah, I realize it sounds like something out of Catch-22, you know, Ossarian would have come up with it. To Joe Heller's novel, but it's true. And it's a little more complex than that, but that's really the fundamental core of it. And this, I believe, was a Supreme Court decision, in fact. My It's Shane? It's in the Constitution.
Quick.
Oh, okay. So, Shane, sovereign immunity. That's right, sovereign immunity. Okay. Yeah, you can't sue a government unless they decide that you can sue them. So, Jim, thanks for the call. Excellent question. Excellent question. It's a bummer of an answer. Martin in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. Hey, Martin.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. I have a comment about the war crimes,
mm-hmm.
Putting these people on trial.
Mm-hmm.
For war crimes, you know, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, et al.
Yeah.
And also I need a recommendation from you for a good book. But first, when it comes to these war crimes, I just don't think it's going to happen when it comes to putting them on trial, because if you do that and they're found guilty, then the next administration that comes in will not be able to commit the same war crimes.
Yeah.
And the Clinton administration was a really good example. You know, he could have been put on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity, but instead they impeached him for
having a little whoopee in the White House. Yeah. What was the crime that Bill Clinton,
you know,
committed?
Said, well, we'll try and get rid of him that way.
Yeah.
They didn't impeach
him. Are you talking about Bosnia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert on that. I think that there's still a genuine debate to be had. I remember, you know, watching the TV anxiously for months and months and saying, why don't we do something? Those people are starving. But I, you know, I get it but Martin, you ask about a recommendation for a book. My number one book about that whole era would be Vince Bugliosi's book. The guy who wrote Helter Skelter, who is the prosecutor in Los Angeles who prosecuted Charles Manson. And he wrote a book called The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. And it is a prosecutor's brief against George, on behalf of we the people for the prosecution of George W. Bush. And it's brilliant. And in fact, Vince Bugliosi, it's spelled like it's pronounced Bugliosi, but he drops the G. Vince Bugliosi has been on this program a couple of times about that book and others. He wrote a book on the JFK killing that he and I disagree about. But his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, is brilliant. Check it out. Martin, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, Vince Bugliosi has gone so far as to say some unkind things about me in my book about the JFK. But I still recommend his book on George W. Bush. She's a good guy. Take you back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And just to close the circle on Vince Bugliosi, or Bugliosi if you're trying to spell it, he says Bugliosi. And his book, The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, his whole point was that in order to prosecute somebody for murder, you have to have standing. In other words, there has to be a law against murder. And the laws against murder in the United States are not federal laws. They're state laws. Every one of the 50 states has a law against murder. And they vary from state to state. What is first-degree murder? What is second-degree murder? What's, you know, but they all have laws against murder. And so any governor of any state, or any attorney general, actually, of any state in the United States could say, okay, we're going to be the state that prosecutes George W. Bush for murder. And Bugliosi, who was as I pointed out earlier, the prosecutor who prosecuted Charles Manson, put that guy in prison for the rest of his life. He's still there. He wrote Helter Skelter. He offered to be the prosecutor for free, pro bono. So, anyhow, Howard in Miami, Florida. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Two things. One, or maybe three. First, I remember one time a while ago, you mentioned a particular political strategist, the Republican political strategist, who said that the Republicans should run up great amounts of debt while they're in power, and then after the Democrats take over, they can accuse them of being responsible for all the problems that exist as a result of this having...
Well, then they could force the Democrats to slow spending, which would be shooting their own Santa Claus, which is... You know, unemployment benefits and Social Security and Medicare and things like that. It's called the Two Santa Claus Theory. It was originally written up in the Wall Street Journal, as I recall, and it was in 1976, and it was by Jude Winiski.
Jude, could you spell that for me?
J-U-D-E, and I think it's W-A-N-I-S-K-I. Might be two N's.
W, Okay, because I want to...
But if you, I'll tell you, if you just plug Two Santa Claus Theory and my name, Tom Hartman, into DuckDuckGo, you know, the search engine or Google or any other search engine, you will find several articles that I've written about this topic over the years, many of them with links back to the original article that Jude wrote and how it's been played out. Because I was saying this, you know, during the George W. Bush administration, I was pointing this out. We've been doing this show since 2002 or 2003. And during the Bush administration, I was like, they're spending like crazy and nobody's saying a word about it because that's the Republican strategy. You know, is run up as much debt as you can, as fast as you can, and set the course for future debt as bad as you can, which George W. Bush did. You know, you can't negotiate Medicare prices, for example. You're going to inherit these wars, for example. And then when a Democrat comes into power, starts screaming about the national debt and saying it's an existential threat to democracy and force that Democrat to do something like, putting a chain CPI on Social Security. So the Democrat has to shoot the Democratic Santa Claus because the Republicans were tired of being beat because the Democrats owned Santa Claus or, you know, broad American Santa Claus. So, you know, Howard, that's where I would go with that. Catherine in Seattle. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Oh, hi. I finally got you. Well, I'm not about to tell you something that nobody's thought of about this Iran-Iraq war.
Mm-hmm.
Chalmers Johnson wrote a book. You've had him on your program.
We have.
He wrote a book called The Sorrows of Empire. And in the back of that book, in the notes section, he tells about something that absolutely floored me. He said during the Reagan administration, Donald Rumsfeld, and this was published in the papers. I guess everybody's forgotten. Donald Rumsfeld was sent to Iraq to give Saddam Hussein WMDs to fight Iran.
That's correct. And in fact, there's a famous photo that you can easily find on the internet of Don Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein when
yes.
they signed the deal. You know, in fact, back in 2002, when I was having these debates with people like Cliff, and they were saying, oh, yeah, there's weapons of mass destruction. And I was saying, well, I think that they've all been destroyed. But to the extent that there were weapons of mass destruction, of course, Rumsfeld would know about it. He sold them to him.
But the Israelis tipped him off. He said that Saddam Hussein, he said that Saddam Hussein, obviously told Bush, had given them to Syria.
Hmm.
Now, that has just been validated by the Obama administration. He drew the red line.
So Ronald Reagan gave them to Saddam, who gave them to Bashir al, whatever his name is, the Assad in Syria. And so it all comes back to Ronald Reagan once more. My tombstone, it all began with Reagan. Catherine, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Rich in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Tom. Good. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Yeah, you know, there's another great book I bought, Vincent Bugliosi, called In the Sea Will Tell. I don't know if you've ever read that.
I have not.
About a murder back in the 70s, a guy out on Christmas Island out in the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
And I was curious as to when that about you.
Your phone is breaking up, Rich. Do you want to try it one more time? I think if Rich was calling on a cell phone, I think he just drove into a dead zone. We have lost Rich. Lori in Mashpee, Massachusetts. Hey, Lori.
Hey, Tom. First-time caller. I've been listening to you since before the Iraq War started.
Wow. Thank you.
I was watching Rachel Maddow's documentary on hubris, and when I noticed I think it was an outline on how to connect the dots and selling the product, one of the things mentioned was anthrax. Now, anthrax was not an option that they really went with, although I know Tom Daschle, who I think left the Senate shortly after this, was one of the victims of
Pat Leahy.
And I think their vote actually altered after the
it did. And Tom, in order to get the Patriot Act passed, it had to get out of Pat Leahy's Judiciary Committee, and Tom Daschle had to bring it to the floor of the Senate. And they were both inclined to say no. They both got anthrax in the mail. They both changed their minds. And I don't think that that's a coincidence, and I think it's bizarre that we haven't figured out where that anthrax came from. If anybody, you know, wants to start a conspiracy theory that I might salute, you could start with that one. Lori, thank you for the call. I'm sorry we're out of time. Corporate profits are up. This is coming up tomorrow. Employee paychecks down. Conservatives are still against the minimum wage. What's wrong with this picture? will confront conservative economist Harry Verser. Plus, my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science, and the best of the best of news, along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires your participation. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.